Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Caring for People during COVID-19 conference call. I would now like to introduce Michael Prince. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. This is Michael Prince. I am the board chair of Community Living BC Board of Directors, and it's my pleasure and honor to moderate this second CLBC teleconference call for individuals and families related to our sector. I first of all just like to make an acknowledgement again that we begin by our expressing our gratitude that the lands from which we are calling in from today are on First Nations traditional territories wherever you happen to be in BC. Hope our listeners are doing okay, staying safe, and staying connected. I also just want to acknowledge that today, April 2nd, is World Autism Awareness Day. And the UN Secretary General earlier today just said we must ensure that a prolonged disruption caused by COVID-19 does not result in the rollback of the rights of people with autism. And then he spoke more broadly about the rights of all persons with disabilities are universal human rights. So I think that was a very appropriate message from the UN Secretary General, and just a mark today is World Autism Awareness Day. Our format today, slightly different from last week. We have three speakers, but we will be joined by Minister Simpson around noon today, so we'll wait for him to participate at that stage of the phone call. But we also have with us, joining us again, Ross Chilton, the CEO of Community Living BC. And we're also pleased again to have Dr. Danielle Bain-Smith, the Deputy Provincial Health Officer, who at the last moment was able to juggle around some meetings and has been able to join us right from the start of this call this morning. So I appreciate both of you making those efforts to be available. So our format will be a bit like last week. I'll invite Ross Chilton and Dr. Bain-Smith to make some opening remarks, and then we've got a series of questions which have come in from families and self-advocates over the last week, which we've put together and try to cover as much as we can to hear from both Dr. Bain-Smith and Ross Chilton. And around noonish, we'll have the minister joining us, and there'll be some questions specifically for the minister to address. So if I could invite you, Ross, to begin with some opening remarks, please.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. And it is great to have a second opportunity to connect with all of you because so much is happening, right, week to week, that it's important we all remain connected. It's a very challenging time. We're hearing from all of you that just the uncertainty, the sudden changes, wondering what the future will hold is a huge source of stress to self-advocates, to families, to home share providers, and to the support staff that we all rely so significantly on. So it's definitely a hard time. Unfortunately, but probably not unexpectedly, COVID-19 has now directly affected some of the people connected to community living. So we are aware of some self-advocates that have tested positive for the virus. That includes individuals that live in group homes, shared living, and with their families, so across a variety of settings. We also know of agency staff, home share providers, and families themselves that have tested positively for COVID-19. I guess the hard part is that we expect over the coming days, weeks, and possibly months that the numbers in the community, the growth within the community transmission will continue to grow and will continue to affect people connected to community living. Like all of you, I'm hopeful that our individual and collective efforts that we seem increasingly determined to apply will help us to, as Dr. Henry describes, bend the curve. As you've heard from Dr. Henry and Minister Dix and the Premier, we have to remain vigilant at this time in order to see the apex and start to see a decline in the number of cases. I certainly have heard through a variety of mechanisms that a lot of you are very worried that the resources of healthcare system won't be there for self-advocates when they need it. And that's certainly an understandable worry given the history of how people with disabilities have been treated during times of crisis. And certainly I hope that some of the reassurances that are coming out of the provincial health office are of some solace to all of you. I am pleased to report that the evidence that we have so far is that the self-advocates that are testing positive for COVID-19 are getting the kind of care they need. The health authorities have responded by providing guidance and support so that most of the individuals can get better at home. There was some requirements for a few individuals that were hospitalized, but my understanding is that they're getting better each day and look forward to being home soon. I guess we do have to accept that others will get ill and that we're going to continue to need to work together through the challenges that that will present to us. And also just the emotional toll that I think this is taking on everybody, that we need to focus both on physical and emotional health. And that means reaching out to each other, staying connected, and trying to respond to the fact that the isolation is hard on anybody. But if you're a person with a disability and you may have experienced having less people in your life than you would like to have, and now you're self-isolating at home, that can be very challenging. I know I've been quite inspired to hear of just stories from families and friends and neighbors who are really doing everything they can to reach out to make sure that people are taken care of, both physically and emotionally. And so, Michael, I might leave it there and hand it back to you.
All right. Thank you, Ross. And please, Dr. Bainchrist, some opening remarks from you would be welcome.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Ross. And thank you again for the invitation to come and participate in the call this morning. I'll also just acknowledge that I'm very grateful to be calling in from the traditional territories of the Lekwungen peoples of the Songhees and Esquimalt Nations. I'm a very grateful visitor here. thank you, Ross, for your comments. And I think maybe I'll just expand on a few of them and just add in a quick little information bullet about testing. So first off, I just want to say on behalf of Dr. Henry that she is absolutely considering the unique needs of people with disabilities through COVID-19 and really does want to ensure that you're aware that that you're very much being considered throughout the development of the COVID response. There has been just a tremendous amount of work happening behind the scenes at the provincial level, at the health authority level, to prepare for what may come, what we've seen happen in the epidemic curve in other jurisdictions, other countries that are a little bit farther ahead than we are, and it's really been remarkable. So our overarching goal with the epidemic is to keep those who are most vulnerable for severe disease safe and to ensure that our healthcare system continues to function and has capacity to help those of us who need it, certainly including people with disabilities. On the note of protecting those who are most vulnerable to severe disease, I did want to just for a moment reflect on both BC's numbers, but also what's been happening around the world. So if you heard Dr. Henry's media yesterday, you'll know that we are over 1,000 diagnosed cases of COVID-19 in the province. There are positive cases across every health region. However, Vancouver Coastal Health and the Lower Mainland Fraser Health continue to be where the bulk of the cases are currently. What we're seeing in terms of who's experiencing the most severe disease, it really is in the elderly. So unfortunately, of the 25 deaths that we've experienced in BC, all of those have happened in people over the age of 64. So we know, and that echoes with what we see in other places around the world, that people who are elderly and those who are elderly with other conditions are those who are most at risk. And so really the efforts and the responses that are going into place have that in mind. And so we're, doing what we can to protect people who are elderly and those with other chronic health conditions. As Ross mentioned, the virus has spread. There is ongoing community spread, community transmission, and mentioned that there were cases in some group homes on the Lower Mainland. It's really important to recognize that that's a reflection of where we are on the epidemic curve, that with this particular virus, it does spread exponentially, certainly if we are doing nothing. What's excellent in BC is that on March 12th, when we recognized and when it became clear to us how widespread spread the virus was in our neighbors to the south. Dr. Henry and the province acted very swiftly as soon as they became aware of that and implemented the public health measures that we're all, doing our best to implement. And bearing the fruit of those public health measures is really going to become clear over the next few days and week in terms of how effective those measures are in terms of flattening the curve. That said, we do know that we're not testing everybody right now, and that is not the appropriate strategy given where we are in the epidemic curve. So I don't want people to feel concerned or think that they're getting lesser care because they're not being tested. In fact, that isn't the right strategy for right now for a couple of reasons. The first is that the test that we have for COVID-19 is not very sensitive. And what that means, that's a scientific term, but what that means is that if somebody has no symptoms or very mild symptoms, there's a high likelihood that we could get a false negative test result. So when we're thinking about a screening test, something that's going to be able to help us behave differently or act differently to prevent the virus spread, the test that we have for COVID-19 is not good for that, because if we were to swab 5 people with early disease who had COVID-19, 2 out of the 5 times we would incorrectly tell them that they didn't have COVID-19. And as you can imagine, that would lead them to do all kinds of things that may not be in keeping with the public health measures, and they might in fact spread the disease. So that's a really important point that I want to share with you, because I think there's a lot of information right now in the media and actually coming from the World Health Organization saying test, test, test. There's actually more context to that. What that slogan really means is test the right people at the right time in your epidemic curve. And in BC, that is what we are doing. So we have very strategic testing guidelines that align with the World Health Organization. That said, there's just 2 other key points I want to make, and then I'll conclude these opening remarks. So we're not going to test everybody right now, because that's not the guidance or the strategy. But what that means is that there is community transmission happening. We know that. And so we also know that people are going to experience COVID-19, and they're not necessarily going to know. They're not necessarily going to have a test that confirms that. And so that's why it becomes really important that we all do our best to implement those public health measures that include physical distancing, so staying, you know, at least 2 arm lengths away from people if we can when we're outside of the home. The frequent hand hygiene, which is probably the most effective way that we can prevent the spread of the virus, is by washing our hands frequently. And then, of course, the other piece of that is if we are sick, if we're having symptoms of fever, cough, or sneezing, to stay away from other people. The last thing I just want to mention is to remind people that COVID-19 for most people under the age of 65 will follow a fairly mild course. So most people, about 80% of people who have COVID-19, will experience something like a common cold, or maybe more, a little bit more like the flu. But 80% of people can be managed safely at home without the need for hospitalization or any extra care. So I just want to remind people of that, because, of course, everything we see in the news, and I had a colleague today who said, you know, I think it's triggering a COVID-19 induced anxiety, which it is. And so I just want to be really clear and remind people that for most people, this illness will be fairly mild. And we see that reflected in our BC numbers. So of the over 1,000 cases that we have in BC, about half of them, so well over 500 or might even be closer to 600 today, are actually fully recovered now from COVID-19. So I will end there. I apologize. I think I went a little bit over my 3 to 5 minutes, but I had some extra information to share. Thank you.
No, thank you, Doctor. And I appreciate your adding nuance and context to a lot of messages that most people are hearing in the media. And it's nice to get this more specifics and the rationale and the health science behind them. So no, thank you for that. Okay, we'll now turn to addressing a number of the questions that we've received at CLBC over the last week or so from self-advocates and family members, and we'll try to get through as many of them as we can. The first one comes from some family members. It's a kind of a two-part question. The first part might go to you, Dr. Bain-Smith. Second part to Ross Chilton. The questions are this: how does CLBC help support those individuals where the home is not the safest place for them because of their unique needs? Or what if the family is simply unable to provide the additional hours of support for the individual at home with no day programming? So I'm not sure. Perhaps, Ross, you might want to go first on this one and address the question of what if the family is unable to provide the additional hours and there's no day program there for the family.
Yeah, and one of the things that's been very helpful out of the provincial health office is to continue to give guidance for providers in terms of how they support people to for both their physical and for their emotional health. And as you know, we've required our service providers to make absolutely massive changes in the way they support people in a very, very short period of time. And that's been based on the guidance and the new guidance, including guidance we provided yesterday from the Provincial Health Office, in terms of trying to support people so there's as little congregation as possible. Because what we're trying to prevent is the transmission from support staff to individuals, or individuals to individuals, or individuals to support staff. So there simply isn't enough staff in the sector to replace all of the congregate services with one-on-one support. There just is not the number of people that we would need to do that. So what the agencies have been doing is trying to look at the unique circumstances of individuals and families and give those that need the support the most support. And those that have indicated and can demonstrate that they can rely on a little less support or even temporarily suspend the support they're receiving, that those families, those individuals getting less support. Now, if a family does feel that they can't manage with the level of support they're getting through the crisis, they certainly should talk to their provider if necessary to engage CLBC in that. But conversely, if an individual or family feels like they could get by with less support for the time being, they should also let their provider know that. Because really what we're trying to do is apply the finite number of support hours that are available to the people that need it the most.
Okay, thanks, Ron. So Dr. Bain-Smith, maybe you could share some thoughts on what guidance you'd suggest for supporting people where the home isn't the safest place for them, but at the same time trying to reduce interactions with other people.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. I probably could have covered this in my opening remarks as well, but one of the real challenges before us is striking a balance between these extreme public health measures and implementing them to the exact letter of the law, which can create harms and challenges. And so there does need to be some balance there and some nuance, as you mentioned, Michael. And so I think it's helpful when we're thinking through this question to really go back and think about what the risk of transmission, when it's highest and when it might be, what are the things we can do to decrease the risk? And so really we know that while the virus can spread before people develop symptoms, that's minimal and that's not what's driving the epidemic. So when the virus is spreading in the largest amount is when people have fever, cough, and sneezing, when they're really quite sick. So in those situations, that's why we're asking people who are sick to stay away from others. And then the way that the virus is spread is through infected droplets. So when we're thinking about being out in the world, so if being home isn't the safest place or that's creating unique challenges, then we want to think through, okay, well, how can we be outside of the home and still be reducing the chance of transmitting the virus? So as Ross mentioned, one of the key elements is reducing the number of different individuals that are interacting. So the smaller the number, the better in terms of reducing those interactions. The second thing we can do is increase the space between individuals. Those infected droplets can travel up to a maximum distance of 2 meters. So if we're more than 2 meters away from other people, we're not going to be exposed to their infected droplets. The third thing is that frequent hand hygiene and hand washing, so that if we are out in the world or even in our own home, because we know that with people coming and going, it is possible to get that community transmission. So if we are washing our hands frequently with plain soap and water, you don't need a fancy antimicrobial soap, plain soap and water, or an alcohol-based hand rub if your hands aren't visibly soiled is good too. That will get any infected droplets off your hands, and then they can't make their way into your eyes, nose, or mouth to give you COVID-19. So I think that it's really important to, in each setting, be able to think through how can I, if I can't implement these, social distancing and self-isolation to the absolute letter of the law, what are the ways in which that I can strike that balance so that we're not creating more harms by implementing those measures, but at the same time doing our best to reduce the spread of the virus outside in the community.
Okay, thank you. Okay, speaking of settings and that, we've got some questions that refer to staff, residential settings and day programs, home sharing providers. So let's see if we can get touch on these as we go through here. Next question to you, Ross, perhaps. If agencies are no longer offering day programs as a responsible physical distancing measure, how will these funds be redirected to home share providers or to families who now would have to provide additional support? And would this be perhaps in the form of respite?
Thanks, Michael. And so for all of you to know that 80% of the funding that we provide to agencies goes directly to paying their staff. So the support staff are the main cost. In the vast majority of situations where these day programs have closed, the staff have been redeployed to supporting individuals in a different setting. So it's not like there's a lot of workers who are sitting idle. We need to have those workers supporting the people in different settings and as I said, applying that to the people that need it the most. So that's why the providers have focused on adjusting the way they support people rather than simply closing it. We do understand that this is certainly for some home share providers, for some families, they are taking on some of the responsibilities that typically would have been provided by a service provider. And we're taking a look at that, discussing that with our ministry, and hope to be able to sort of announce some things in the coming weeks.
Okay. So here's one that perhaps both for Dr. Bainsmith and you, Ross. How is CLBC going to support home sharing providers and the families and support workers if they get sick? So maybe Dr. Bainsmith, you can talk a bit about what kind of protocols your office and Dr. Henry have developed on this in terms of symptoms and tests and so forth. And then Ross, you can get to talking more specifically about CLBC. Dr. Bainsmith?
Yes. So There is a very formal public health protocol that is followed whenever somebody tests positive for COVID-19. So that triggers an investigation by the local medical health officer and their staff. Whereby they do contact tracing. At that time, they will meet with the person who has tested positive for COVID-19 and do a very detailed conversation history with them to understand who they've been in contact with during their period of infectiousness. So again, I just mentioned earlier that the prime period of infectiousness is when people are having symptoms. So they will walk through and find out where that person's been, who they've been in contact with. They also determine the risk of the contact, and I don't think I mentioned that just a moment ago, but the highest risk contact is that which is defined as close contact, meaning that you're face-to-face with somebody and the person who's sick is not wearing a mask or, you know, doesn't have anything covering them, and you're within 2 meters with them. And you're in that sort of close contact for more than 15 minutes. So they will go through and identify all the people and their level of risk in terms of having been in contact with that person who's tested positive. And from there, they will contact all of those people that are at risk to walk them through what that means, what they should do next, the person who's been exposed. And all of the different steps that they need to know and follow through with to minimize the chance that they will spread the virus.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to the contact tracing, they go through very detailed guidance with the individual that's tested positive for COVID-19 around how what they need to do to make sure that they don't spread the virus to anybody else. They also provide guidance about when somebody should get medical attention. Like I said, 80% of people are going to be able to stay home, stay self-isolated, and recover on their own. There is a smaller group of people who might end up with a little bit more trouble breathing and might need that help at the hospital. And so the medical health officers will, you know, give them all of the details they need around when they should seek out that higher level of care. And then lastly, they also walk through and let the people know when they can go back to their regular routines. So again, 80% of people are going to just get better on their own. And like we see here in BC, 500 to 600 people have recovered. So they also walk people through when they can come out of that self-isolation.
Great. Thank you. Ross?
Yeah, and Michael, as I mentioned in my opening remarks, we really have already seen all three of these scenarios play out where either the home share provider, the family, or the support workers have become ill. And, of course, a huge, huge worry in terms of who will be there to support them. Each case is going to be unique in terms of what the situation is and, therefore, what the solutions are required to be implemented. So that's what our staff, along with the agency staff, have been doing in each of these cases, is they have been working with the family, working with the home share provider, or working with the agency to look at how can things be adjusted, how do they need to be adjusted to continue to keep people well. I mean, we've had examples where the person living in the home share environment was not affected, but one of the home share providers was. And so the second home share provider was taking care of that person who was remaining in isolation, but they were also able to continue to support the individual that lived with them. This has also been true in certain family situations. So, you know, the good news is Dr. Bain Smith is saying that probably the majority of people are going to get ill and get through that without requiring any form of hospitalization, and therefore we'll be able to apply our sort of resources to those that that find themselves in a more difficult situation and therefore need more support.
Okay. Next question is from some family members, and perhaps directly to you, Dr. Bain Smith. It's what happens if a supported individual is hospitalized? What supports do they get? More specifically, the question is there a policy in place that would enable a parent or a support person to stay with that individual who had to be hospitalized?
Thank you. And this is such an important question. I have elevated it up to the team within our Health Emergency Command Center who is working directly with the hospitals and health authorities. So I don't have a clear answer for you today. I do know that hospitals have put in place restrictions on visitors, but I think this is a very unique situation and scenario. And I do know that they have considered different scenarios where visitation would be certainly important and essential. So I've sent it up the chain to the other group, and I will loop back with Ross so that I can get that information back to you.
That'd be great. Thank you. Okay. Clearly that's something that'd be on the minds of a lot of people through the province, so appreciate that. One for you, Ross, is what role, this is a very CLBC question around the role of our facilitators and analysts, what role they play in helping service providers and families work out adequate service levels, especially if there's some dispute or disagreement or, different perspectives being brought to bear on what needs to be done when.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. And the primary relationship we always know is between the service provider that is providing the support and the family. And so what we have seen so far is that almost all of these adjustments have been made successfully in conversations between families and service providers. We do need to be realistic in understanding of that these service providers simply do not have enough workers for everyone to be supported individually. So they are going to need to assign their staff based on priority needs. But if the agency and the family can't reach agreement, despite their conversations, the family certainly can reach out to the CLBC facilitator to explain that situation and ask that CLBC become involved in the problem solving. So we encourage you to kind of come in good faith, offer to do what you can do as a family member, take the support that's being offered, but if it at the end of the day isn't enough and you can't reach agreement, then we're happy to become involved.
Great. I think thank you, Ross. Here's one we're hearing a lot about in the news in the last several days. For both of you, a family member asks about the shortage of personal protective equipment, PPE. Can you please give us an update as to the availability of these supplies for the needs in our sector? So perhaps Dr. Bain-Smith, if you'd want to begin?
Sure, yes, absolutely. Yes, I wish I had better news to report on this front, but that is correct, that personal protective equipment is definitely in short supply, and specifically what we mean by that is masks, so surgical-type masks. As I said before, masks can be helpful when somebody has a fever, cough, and sneeze because it can help to keep an infected person's droplets in. Masks are not proven to be helpful necessarily to prevent somebody from getting infected. One reason is that if you put your mask on and off incorrectly, you can actually contaminate yourself, which might be higher risk. The other reason is that the virus can also get into our system through our eyes. So if we're just wearing a mask for protection, we still have sort of that other surface area that can be a source for the virus to get into our bodies. So just a quick note about when a mask might be helpful, and it's really if you've got somebody who's sick, coughing and sneezing with a fever to keep their infected droplets in. So on the note of masks, what's happened is that the province has stood up a provincial working group that has collected the needs across both the health sector and all the other sectors to understand what the need for masks is around the province, and then they've created a one-window system to negotiate with the federal government to create a reliable, consistent supply chain. That supply chain is not yet at the consistent and reliable phase. There has been a lot of work, and again, speaking to the flurry of activity, this is something that has kept many, many people awake at night, and there's many, many people that are working on getting as many supplies as possible into BC. There is a personal protective equipment allocation framework that's been developed by the Health Emergency Command Center. It was drafted with many ethicists, according to the ethical framework for COVID-19 that's been developed. And so that is really what's guiding personal protective equipment use in the healthcare setting right now. Going back to those, you know, that overarching goal of keeping our healthcare system running, so that if and when those of us who get ill and need hospital care, it is there for us. Mm-hmm. That has really been the driving force behind the ethical decisions around how PPE masks are being distributed currently. So as I say, I don't come today with a great message in terms of we don't have, you know, a warehouse someplace that has a ton of masks ready to go for everybody. We're having to use our masks, appropriately and judiciously. And there is a ton of work happening to, get us past this current scenario and get us to the place where we've got, you know, an adequate supply and a buffer for everybody. Nice. The other note I would just mention is that there is also a lot of work happening outside of healthcare, looking at other industries, looking for innovative solutions that will create that physical barrier so that people can cover their coughs and sneezes more effectively. And so things like 3D printing of face shields and all sorts of things that are happening also at the same time. So I just want to really let people know that there are tons and tons and tons of people that are working tirelessly on this specific issue. And although I don't have a very good news story to report today, I hope that that will change over the coming days and weeks.
Okay. Ross, you know, specifically to the community living sector, you know, as their CEO, remarks around the PPE situation?
Yeah, and as Dr. Bain-Smith said, like even driving in to work with my wife today, and she's a secondary school principal, and you know, they've gone through and they've found all the goggles that they would typically use in the science classes. They pulled together any kind of gloves that they have in the first aid, and this is really what we're trying to do right now is where there are supplies that are sort of sitting on shelves and not immediately necessary, collecting them so that they can be provided where they're needed most. But it really requires a discipline in the application. So far I've seen that. So an example with two different group homes, one where the individual who has COVID-19 can understand and follow the personal distancing and the isolation guidelines that are provided by staff. They didn't need PPE equipment in that situation, so the health authority provided masks, but not everything. It's just important that the person is able to self-isolate and to get better in their home. However, you know, in another nearby home, that wasn't possible. The individual required personal care as part of their daily routines, and of course the staff therefore needing to be close to the person and them requiring that. In that case, the health authority came through with some supplies for that home so that that person could get better without putting others, including their staff, at risk of transmission, and that that support could be provided in the home. So far, you know, it is, as Dr. Bain-Smith said, a global challenge right now, but people are doing the right things.
All right. Good. Here's a question that I think we've heard a lot. I've certainly heard, and I know you have, Ross, and from some families, is where staff are coming into your home. How can we be assured that they are following social distancing or physical distancing and other protocols required by the Ministry of Health? Should staff be coming in at all if they're also going to other people's homes too? So Dr. Dane Smith, what's the latest guidance on this?
Yeah, thank you, Michael. And of course, I'm going to sound like a bit of a broken record.
Oh, keep playing.
yeah, but it is important to think through, again, the epidemiology of this particular virus, and that while we do know that, you know, some transmission and some virus spread can happen before somebody has clear symptoms, that's not the main way in which that the virus is spread. It's mostly spread when people have symptoms of fever, cough, sneezing. So, you know, we are encouraging everybody, and certainly staff who are, you know, going into different settings, that if they are not feeling well, that they should not go into different settings. They should stay home and self-isolate. That is also one of the reasons that we have the strategic testing that I mentioned earlier that includes healthcare workers in that list. It does not at this point include social service providers. However, we do recognize that there's a lot of people that work in, for example, a long-term care setting and then might also work in a group home. And so in that scenario, that group would be eligible for testing. Regardless of what the test result says, if people are sick, they should be doing the most that they can to be away from other people. So I would say that as, you know, the number one thing is that if the staff member is coming in and they're not, you know, visibly ill, then the risk of virus spread is not zero, but it's certainly not as high as it would be if somebody was sick. The next piece of that would be that frequent hand hygiene and the cleaning and disinfection. So that if everybody is washing their hands frequently, then we're reducing the chance that some infected droplets can get transferred from any person into a new person. And then lastly, the cleaning and disinfection. Regular cleaning products are sufficient to kill this virus. And so we do recommend cleaning and disinfecting high-touch surfaces twice a day if possible. So that would be light switches, faucets, counters, and those types of things. So those are the main ways that people could help prevent the virus coming into their setting, and then also if it did happen to come into their setting, those are the ways that they could prevent the virus from actually getting into their body and getting sick themselves.
Okay. Ross, CLBC's efforts to work on this with service providers?
Yeah, and Dr. Bain-Smith provided some additional guidance that we share with providers yesterday. For example, when people are being supported during the day together, it's really what we need to do is for people that live in the same home to be supported together, not across homes. And same thing with staff is to reduce the number of staff that are involved with supporting a particular individual or working in a particular home. Had the guidance applied it to community social services and limited workers to one location, there would have been a scary lack of workers in the ability to meet all the very core needs. And that's why the provincial health office kind of did is they're having to do a lot now is sort of weigh the kind of the benefits and the risks. And what they realized is that if staff are taking the right precautions, if they are going into as few homes as possible, if they're interacting with as few people as possible, that's about the best it gets. But if there is an individual that could do without the support for a period of time, then certainly that's better too. The fewer people you have coming in, the better. The hard part can be sometimes the organizations are having to say that to family members as well, because if a family member is coming into the home, and again, there's the risk of them bringing the virus themselves into the home, and so we're encouraging families to, where they can, to look at staying connected in other ways through phone calls and through Skype.
Yeah, how to keep that social connection, but also practice a safe physical distancing. Okay, great. Have we got the minister online yet, or? Okay, we've got lots of questions, so hopefully he will be able to join us soon. But Ross, one right to you, which again I think is on a lot of people's minds. How will CLBC address the needs of people who may not be getting regular CLVC services at the present time but are eligible. For example, they may be eligible for living independently or with family support. During this time of this crisis and this extraordinary challenges, where are you going on with that?
Thanks, Michael. So on a typical day, when we don't have a pandemic, we would have sort of 3 to 4 new individuals present to CLVC absolutely every day seeking services. And, of course, some people who are in receipt of services that require either a change in service or an increase in service. So what I would say is that even though our facilitators and analysts are working flat out to kind of work with families, home share providers, and agencies just to problem solve right now, we do continue to be open to operate to individuals that are new to us or individuals that are presenting new needs. So all of our 37 offices are still open, and we're working with a skeleton staff in those offices just, again, to prevent the risk of transmission. But the staff are still working either in those offices or from home, and they're available to the individuals and families that need them.
Okay. Another one to you, Ross, was from a self-advocate around question of, we've already covered employment supports. The self-advocate writes, I receive CLVC-funded employment supports. Now that I don't have a job, will I lose those supports? Pretty good question, I'd say. Another one related to that was, will I be able to access CLVC services as they were before COVID-19 when this is over? So someone with a little optimism there looking ahead, but also wondering access to CLVC-funded employment support.
Happy to answer those, Michael. And you know, it is important to look forward, right? This will come to an end at some point. And, how will life sort of get back to normal? I know I'm certainly looking forward to the idea of things being normal again. So what I would say to that person is they won't lose the support they're receiving, but the way they're being supported might change. So if the person temporarily lost their job due to the COVID-19 crisis, the support would probably focus more on how they are emotionally and financially managing while being off work and until the crisis is over. That person might need some help with applying for EI or kind of just, again, trying to stay socially connected. If the person has permanently lost their job, then the focus would probably be on getting ready to apply for a new job once things start to get back to normal. And as you know, Michael, we know that employment is super important, and CLVC and their agencies remain committed to supporting people either to return to their previous work or to find new work. But when it comes to accessing services, kind of the way it was before, that one's a bit more challenging to answer because I think for most people the answer is going to be yes. But for others, we might find that the way they're being supported as they go through this crisis is different, but also becomes preferred. Sometimes we'll find in a crisis that new and better things emerge or more innovative approaches to support emerge after the crisis. We wouldn't want them just to return to exactly the way they were. You know, I can't remember if I shared the example of a doctor's appointment I had to have recently where the doctor called me and talked to me for about 5 to 7 minutes while I was in my office, told me what to do, and I didn't have to drive to that appointment and go to his office and potentially come into contact with somebody else who was sick, come drive all the way back to work. So, I don't know what health's going to do, but I sure hope that's one of the changes that continues for some circumstances afterwards. So I think we have to be open to the idea that some things may change and change for the better.
Yeah. I'm just mindful of time. And if the minister's not on, I know we have the Deputy Minister, David Galbraith, on the line. David, I might want to, just following up on that question, here's a related question from a self-advocate. He says, or she says, I got laid off from my 2 part-time jobs. Can I still apply for EI, employment insurance? Will my PWD, my disability benefit, be affected if I get EI?
Yes, thanks, Michael, and thanks for the opportunity to be here and talking to everyone. I always hate to scoop the minister, but some of you may know the minister, why he hasn't been able to be here is he did an announcement this morning. And on that announcement, he talked about things that the province are implementing. And what they are is, one of them is around EI and the rule that now everyone who's on PWD, any of the EI benefits will be exempted. So yes, please apply for the programming that the federal government has put in place for people that have lost their jobs, and the province will not be clawing that back from the amount that we provide. So the other things, if I could,
I'm on the call now.
Oh, Minister, oh. Thank you. It's all yours.
Over to you, Minister Simpson. We've got about 7 or 8 minutes left, and delighted you're here. Your deputy was just explaining your announcement earlier this morning and why you were probably still doing other interviews and media availability, but we're delighted you're here.
Yeah, just and I won't take a lot of time. I'm sure David explained the components of this, both the exemption, those who will qualify the federal program. There will be no clawback of their current provincial benefits. The $300 across the board for people on income and disability assistance for the next 3 months. For those who don't get the federal benefit, there also for those people who took a Compass card or the bus pass, for starting in April, we will give people the $52 and we'll monitor that as we move forward to see what happens with TransLink and BC Transit as things move forward. What I would say is that this is a supplement, the $300. There's no need to apply for it. It will be made available to people starting with April 22nd. It's in place for the 3 months. We're committed to 3 months. And as with all of the programs that the government is doing, we'll be reviewing that as we move forward at cabinet as we understand how the virus is going to be responded to moving forward. I just want to say thanks to people for their patience. This took us a little bit of time to get it sorted out. There still are some questions around other things, but they're questions related to how the federal government is moving forward with their supports, and obviously there are some significant issues there, and there's conversations going back and forth with the federal government, right from the first minister's level down through finance and a number of ministries in that. But I'm pleased that we were able to get this out the door and give people some certainty about what the plan is moving forward for the next few months. And certainly the initial responses that I've been getting are pretty positive that this will add a little bit of stability to people's lives in a very uncertain time. And I'm going to stop there because you've all been talking a lot, I'm sure.
Well, just a note too, Minister. So this will be in the next check for people?
April 22nd check.
Right.
And we would note for people and to understand, of course, that this affects, so you know, it's people on income assistance, disability assistance, plus low-income seniors. There's about 58,000 seniors who basically get OAS and GIS. They receive a supplement from the province of about $49 a month for that, a senior supplement. We'll be increasing that supplement to $300. We'll be kind of putting the $300 will be available to low-income seniors as well. That's about 58,000 people. And there's about 4,000 folks who are who receive support from the ministry who are in specialized medical care and facilities, and they get a comfort allowance. Today, I think it's $95. We'll be increasing. They also will qualify for the $300 moving forward as well.
I think, as you said this morning in your press statement, a little over a quarter of a million people.
Over a quarter of a million people will receive this support, and we think there's about 20,000 people on earning exemptions, give or take, and probably half of those folks will be eligible for the federal benefit, so they'll get that federal benefit moving forward. And then we'll be capturing everybody that we can with the provincial benefit.
Right, right. And there's no need for additional application for this. You're saying
no.
This is an automatic. Okay.
No need on this. If you require other supplements, because we still have supplements around food and housing and utilities and health supports, all of those supplements that are in place and continue in place, those will require a phone call and an application, but the $300 will be automatically provided to people.
Just one last quick question, Minister. This came in from a self-advocate. Question to you was, for those of us on PWD, can we apply for the rental subsidy that was announced?
That supplement, it was provided to people who lost income, work income, employment income, the up to $500.
Right.
We're not going to make that available because what we've done is we've created the situation with those who would have been working and lost their employment and will qualify for the federal benefit. We know that at a minimum, people will be at least $1,000 better off. And to be quite frank, one of the things that we did with all of the initiatives for moving forward, we looked at what the federal government was doing. We looked at the amount of resources we could invest, starting with the $5 billion of new money that's been put on the table, and said, how do we make sure that we're getting money into a number of people's hands and not be loading up some programs where people are getting two or three benefits where others are getting none? So this is a decision to spread that money around some in this process.
Right. Okay. Thank you. I'm mindful of time. We're 12:15. Ross and Dr. Maine Smith and Minister, maybe if there's some closing remarks, final messages you'd like to leave with our listeners today on this teleconference call. Dr. Maine Smith, perhaps you could go first.
Sure. Thank you, Michael. I'll be brief and just I will thank the, I believe it was a self-advocate that asked in their question about when this is over. And I didn't mention that in my remarks, but I think that is such a critical message that this will not continue forever. This is an epidemic that we're all banding together right now to get through together here in BC. And so I look forward to coming out of the other side of this flattened curve with all of you in the weeks and months to come. Thank you.
Thank you. Ross.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. So, you know, it is great to have a chance to connect with people, and I do appreciate that you're all very busy and to take time to both send us questions and then to participate as part of this call. It seems that the need for communication is quite strong right now, so my advice is going to be that probably in a couple of weeks we'll try to have another one of these calls, and we'll send out the information about that in our traditional ways. But in the meantime, I just, stay safe, stay home, and we're there to work through this with you. So thanks so much, everybody.
Thank you, Ross. And Minister.
Very quickly, all I would say is thank you for all that you're doing. And we truly, as has been said, we are all in this together. We're going to come out of it together. We're going to be okay. It's going to take some time. And I really just say that we need to be generous with each other and graceful with each other and tolerant of each other and pull through this together. And if we do that, we will all be in a better place at the end of the day, and we'll continue to work together to meet the challenges that are in front of us now and that we will see in the coming weeks and months.
Thank you, Minister. So that concludes our second CLBC teleconference call for individuals and families. As you just heard, folks, Ross Chilton has committed to holding another one. We will keep you posted as to the time and date of that in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, keep watch on our website at CLBC and, of course, the Provincial Health Officer's website with many links, as well as at the Ministry of Social Development and Poverty Reduction, to keep you up to date as to not only the pandemic, but also decisions and announcements coming both from the federal government, the provincial government, health authorities, and the Provincial Health Office, as well as CLBC. So thank you all for listening. Hope you're doing okay. Stay safe and stay connected. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes the Caring for People During COVID-19 conference call. Thank you for your participation, and have a nice day.